So far I've been talking about a variety of things prior to my arriving at the University of Wisconsin, and I stressed the importance of religion in my background. By the time I went to Emory, I realized that I needed to get liberated from the extreme theology to which I was exposed. So I chose a major in philosophy. And that was of great importance to me throughout my life. I had a double major in history and philosophy. The philosophy major in the longer term led to my being quite theoretical. And then history training led me to be very empirical. So the combination of theory and empirical analysis, that stayed with me throughout my life. And I think I have been very liberated of theology. I think the way in which Protestantism instills guilt, that's something that one never quite gets liberated from. Then, of course, I had the brief stint at Harvard and then the University of Chicago. While Emory is a great undergraduate institution, and I was not prepared for anything beyond Emory, and I had difficulty surviving my first year. As I look back, I don't think I was ever a very good student, but I don't think I've ever been a very good student. But by the time I got to Chicago, and I was at Harvard for a short time, there were different kinds of people. These were great research institutions. But what's important to note about Chicago and Harvard, these institutions were populated by faculty to a large extent who were deep thinkers. And that had a real impact on me. At the same time in Chicago, as I've indicated, I had the opportunity to teach in the college social science. And that, in the longer term, was to be very important to me. And as I've indicated, I also had courses with Bill McNeil and Dan Boorstin, both of whom, in many respects, were doing comparative analysis. So the kind of comparative analysis to which I was exposed in the history department and the social science to which I was exposed in the college, that has stayed with me all of my life. Then my first major job was at the University of Illinois, and that provided a real transition for me prior to my going to Wisconsin, very important for me. Illinois was a very large public university, a very good university. Its great strength, as I've indicated, was in engineering, physics, and to a lesser extent in agriculture. But it was quite good in history. And so I was taught a great deal. At Illinois, I was treated in a way that I somewhat resented at the time. I did not have tenure, of course, and non-tenured faculty were generally not permitted to teach graduate students. And in fact, many people who had been at Illinois for many years were not permitted to teach graduate students. One had to be given special permission by the graduate school to teach graduate students. But the fact, in a certain sense, the lid was kept on me. I couldn't teach graduate students. But the fact is, I probably wasn't prepared to teach graduate students. And so I got introduced to what it was like to be a regular member of a faculty. Non-tenured faculty were permitted to sit in on all meetings, to vote on whether or not an individual would be hired in the department. Certainly we weren't permitted to vote on who should get or not get tenure. I was asked, in fact, required to teach a course at Illinois on contemporary problems at the global level. That I somewhat resented, and the acting chair of the department was a gentleman by the name of Chester Starr, one of the world's great ancient historians, and here he was eager to have someone teach contemporary problems at the global level, and I recall resisting that. But that was a great experience for me, and it also was an introduction to comparative analysis and global analysis that would later be part of my my career. Then the third year I was at Illinois, I was offered a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh in history, and they had a relatively new chair of that department, a gentleman by the name of Samuel Hayes. Sam had come from the University of Iowa, which was really quite a very good history department. We would later have three people here at Wisconsin from that Iowa department, George Mossy, Robert Kingdon, and Alan Bogue. And here was Sam Hayes, who was at Pittsburgh, and he was developing a kind of social science history program and had appointed a number of excellent young people, and that was a very rich experience for me. On the other hand, it was a bit of a tough experience for me. Sam Hayes was a devout Quaker. He was a person who didn't tolerate much foolishness, and he was not very tolerant of different views. But I learned a great deal from Sam, and while he, I think, was very critical of the kind of training to which I had been exposed, primarily in narrative history, Sam, it was, again, a very fine experience for me that year, and in the longer term, was to be very valuable for me. Then, of course, I returned to Illinois, and then, as I indicated in that year, my fourth year, was offered a tenured a position from the University of Wisconsin. Now, how did that happen? I was later told that a visitor we had to give some lectures at Illinois was a professor, John Higham. John was one of the two or three leading intellectual historians in America at the time. John had received his PhD under Merle Curdy, the great intellectual historian in the country. And for some reason, I must have impressed John Higham, because he was the person who called me to the attention of Wisconsin. I had written a paper then on the anti-intellectualism in American history, and that must have impressed John Higham, and we spent a fair amount of time in the 2 days that he was in Champaign-Urbana. And he was at the University of Michigan at the time, and he would later move to Johns Hopkins. But I think that's the way I was initiated into Wisconsin. At that time, public universities were beginning to expand very rapidly. The year I went to Illinois, they hired five new assistant professors. And the year when I arrived at Wisconsin, it had hired six professors. Three of them were full professors: Alan Bogue, David Herlihy, John DeNovo. David Herlihy probably was the world's leading medieval historian for a few years, later president of the American Historical Association. Alan Bogue, as I indicated, had moved there and was one of these six. He moved there from the University of Iowa, and then the others were assistant professors. So American universities were expanding very rapidly, and in my opinion, they were too loose, generally, in the kind of people they appointed. In retrospect, I think if I were voting, I would not have voted to appoint Rogers Hollingsworth to a tenured position at the time. But so be it. I was appointed, and I think it was very fortunate and good luck for me. Now, when I arrived at Wisconsin, it was totally different from any place to which I had ever been exposed. There were very large classes, The main thing, however, was graduate training for me, teaching graduate seminars. I had never had a graduate seminar at the University of Chicago. I did have courses, as I've indicated, occasionally with only two students, myself and another, or with Bill McNeil, I was the only student. But now in Wisconsin, there was rigorous seminar training for graduate students. And that was a new experience for me. And then there were a number of giants at Wisconsin in history. History was one of the most influential fields aside from the life sciences at Wisconsin. But a number of people who impressed me most were, and who had an enormous impact on me, was Merle Curdy, the great intellectual historian, formerly president of the American Historical Association, Bill Williams. Now, Bill Williams, in my opinion, was the deepest thinker at the University of Wisconsin, a man not so well known today, later president of the Organization of American Historians. Bill, aside from being a deep thinker, was a wonderful person. He probably ended up being worn out at Wisconsin. He would end up having more graduate students than anyone else. A very original person. Bill was considered by most graduate students, especially as we began to enter the war in Vietnam, as a Marxist and a very left-wing individual. But Bill was certainly not a Marxist. And indeed, Bill had a unique and unusual interpretation of American history. Surprisingly, his hero in all of American history was Herbert Hoover. And for someone to be thought by graduate students to be a left-wing Marxist, and his hero being Herbert Hoover, is very interesting. His major book, The Contours of American History, I still read it from time to time. Then there was Phil Curtin. Phil also was one of the real giants in history, though a relatively young person, but when I arrived, he was already a full professor. Phil had been recruited at Wisconsin to teach British Empire, which had been a long tradition at Wisconsin. Phil was a bit of a rebel. He was interested in comparative history, but particularly in African history. He was self-trained, and he, being interested in comparative history, I was somewhat drawn to Phil Curtin. Phil and I were never close friends, but he had an enormous impact on me. Then there was Alan Bogue. And Alan became a kind of mentor to me. Al was some 15 years older than I, primarily an agricultural historian and a historian of the West. Then there was Irv Wiley. Irv was chair of the department and a very somewhat aggressive person, very keen on expanding the size of the history department. Irv and I got along very well, and he was certainly instrumental in recruiting me. There was Mort Rothstein, older than I, but in rank somewhat junior, an assistant professor. Mort and Al Bogue had been trained by Paul Gates, one of the great teachers of American historians, and Mort was in agricultural history. One of the men who had an enormous impact on me, I don't want to say he was a mentor, but this was Willard Hurst in the law school. Willard was probably the leading legal historian in America. He had turned down positions at Harvard and Yale and could have been leading legal historian any place in America. Willard had written a 3-volume history of lumber in Wisconsin. But just a great legal historian, a wonderful man, and he took it upon himself to invite younger professors to his home, and he helped to mentor a number of younger people. Now, the thing that was just incredible about Wisconsin was the scope of history. Just listen to this. Wisconsin had, without a doubt, the leading economic history program in the world. French historians, medieval historians, American historians, and just enormously distinguished historians. Most of them would later leave Wisconsin, which is an interesting story of what happened to economic history at Wisconsin. There was social history. And for the first time, I was introduced to such things as the history of the family, the history of child-rearing practices. And that, to me, was just very exciting. There was the history of education. There was historical geography. One of the key young people then was David Ward, who would later become chancellor at the University of Wisconsin. There was a history of journalism. There was class analysis and historical change. Agricultural history, a major field. I've already mentioned Alan Bogue and Mort Rothstein in this connection. There was a history of the climate, climatology. Probably the world's leading scholar in this field was Reed Bryson. And so for me, to come to this university, in contrast to Harvard and Chicago, where they were sort of deep thinkers and maybe great scholars, here we had people who were enormously distinguished historians, much more narrow, but it was intimidating to me when I got to Wisconsin. And because, as I've indicated before, my father had been interested in everything. And I took it upon myself to try to get to know as many of these people as I could. And I learned a great deal. I might say there was Marshall Claggett in the history of science, one of the great historians of science. He left the year I arrived and went to the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. Now, Wisconsin was very tough for me. Chicago had been involved in working on a textbook, my dissertation, teaching in the college. I thought that I was really busy and that when I began teaching at a university, life would ease up. But it got really amazing. I was expected, along with most of my colleagues, to teach three courses, one of which would be a graduate seminar. That was tough for me. I'd never had a seminar, and now I was expected to teach a graduate seminar, and the universities were expanding very rapidly. By the second year I was at Wisconsin, I probably had 10 or 12 graduate students. A couple of them were already working on dissertations, and for one reason or another had shifted from their major professor to me and to me teaching a graduate seminar at the time was very, very demanding. Also, I was teaching a new course, and when I look back on my career, I'm astounded. What was I expected to teach at Wisconsin, and what did they recruit me to teach? American history from 1877 to 1901. So when I look back on my career and think of the way in which I have become a kind of global historian and doing class or comparative analysis of different countries, it is quite amazing that I was teaching in this rather narrow field. But that was a rich experience for me and quite demanding. I'd never had any formal training in this period, but Wisconsin at that time was beginning to, despite all these great fields, They were also beginning to teach period history. There was colonial history, the Revolutionary period, the Jeffersonian period, the Jacksonian period, the coming of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and so forth and so on. And so they sliced it both ways, here chronologically, and then they had special fields, intellectual history, economic history, and so forth and so on. Now, in the meantime, I guess the individual with whom I had the greatest interaction was my colleague, Alan Bogue. At the time, the history department had offices in all of our offices were in Bascom Hall, and offices were shared by three people. And it was sometimes difficult when you had office hours. And so we sort of sometimes had to negotiate at the time when we might speak one-on-one to students, but more often than not, there was more than one student at the same time. As I said, Wisconsin was expanding very rapidly, and so I had to teach, or I was expected to teach, large classes also. And by the time of my second year, I had classes of somewhere between 100 and 200 students. And of course, we had teaching assistants at the time. And this, again, was completely unlike anything to which I had been exposed, and quite a shocking and very demanding experience. Can we have a break for just a moment?
Continuing the interview with Rogers Hollingsworth here on April 30th, 2015. There's a lot of things I'd like to ask, and I think I'll work. Well, I'll start with what you sort of recently were talking about there, and that's classes you taught. So, what was the specific graduate seminar you taught, or the first one you taught?
That was American History, 1877 to 1901. And as I said, I'd never had any formal training in that period. So I would sometimes go to the library and literally check 15 or 20 books out. And I might just stop at a moment and say that one of the really important classes that I had in high school was a course taught by an English teacher who taught us how to diagram sentences. And so over the years, I have read the following way: subject, verb, and object. And so I learned to scan books. And so I sometimes go through multiple books the same day, just looking for things that might be of interest to me. And so that was sort of a salvation at the time to teach this course when I knew virtually nothing about it. And I would go to the library and get numerous books and was really learning the field as I was teaching it.
Mm-hmm. So then when you taught these large classes early on, what were those large classes? What were the title of those
classes? Well, the same thing.
Okay.
And so that was good. The graduate courses overlapped with the undergraduate. And so, again, I was learning very rapidly. And I was a complete ignoramus, if you will.
So, I'm sorry, I cut across you there at the end. So you literally, you were teaching U.S. history 1877. I mean, you said that earlier, but yeah. You're literally both in small graduate student seminars and in large classes, you are teaching 24 years of U.S. history.
That is correct.
Okay. You mentioned quite a few people in the department and then Willard Hurst in the law school. And, you know, doing comparative history and collaborating has become such a big thing for you. Early on, were there people besides Willard Hurst outside of the history department that you found yourself gravitating to?
Not immediately, but because I'd had the experience with social scientists at Chicago, and because of my experience with Sam Hayes at Pittsburgh, clearly I was oriented toward social science. Because of my experience with Bill McNeil, Dan Boorstin, Phil Curtin, and like, I was also beginning to I think comparatively, this course I taught at Illinois on global problems. So I was teaching this relatively narrow period of American history, hopefully with some depth, at the same time thinking increasingly globally, comparatively, and then increasingly social science, that is, being interdisciplinary. And so this, to me, was a very demanding thing. I began to go knocking on doors in the social science building at Wisconsin. I've never been hesitant to go into a great scholar's office and say, here's a problem I'm interested in. I don't know anything about it. And it's just amazing how receptive people are to a neophyte, or at least to me, they have been. And that has been an exhilarating part of my career. And here at Wisconsin, which is such a huge university, it seems as though there was always someone who had some expertise in anything I was interested in. And I would go and knock on people's doors. In some respect, I think my education really has been here at Wisconsin.
And a couple more things, unless there are things that you you want to talk about. Let me at least ask one more, and then if you want to sort of continue on with what you have down and want to say. You also mentioned part of the toughness, if you will, of coming to UW is the fact that you ended up fairly quickly having a lot of graduate students. Some you inherited, and it sounds like some you probably came, if not to work with you, but eventually, you know, sort of made their way to you. You know, having not worked with graduate students before, I'm wondering early on what your relationship was like with these graduate students who would come in.
Well, at that time, no graduate students were coming to Wisconsin to work with me. I was not known as a scholar in this period of history. But universities were expanding very rapidly. Unbelievable what was happening in American history at the University of Wisconsin. By my second year, there were probably 125 graduate students in American history. Now, that is a bit of an exaggeration in that maybe 20, 25 of those students were working on PhD dissertations and were out in the field, had finished their coursework. But this is one reason why the department was hiring more and more people very rapidly. And so the question is, what to do with these people? And so people like Rogers Hollingsworth, the people were steered to my seminar and the like. And then a couple of my colleagues had more students than they could handle. I remember a young student by the name of Carl Harris, and he moved to my seminar from another professor and was an excellent student, wrote a prize book in my seminar. I was very proud to have him as a student. And so I did very early on have some excellent students, but they had not come to work with me.
I wonder if you've thought about what the benefits and perhaps the detriments were of you coming to UW at a time of this rapid expansion. I mean, sometimes they say that timing is everything. You come to UW when enrollment's up, graduate students are up, faculty being hired. So I'm wondering if this time period in the 60s, if you've ever sort of reflected on what that meant to your work.
Well, to me, I think it was an enormous benefit. I mean, I was someone, and I think I have always been curious to learn something new. This was an amazing environment with things I had never encountered, never even thought about the history of the family, the history of child rearing. I'd never had a course in agriculture. Agricultural history or economic history, and therefore I never had any professors in these fields, and so I was quite ignorant in these areas. I look back and think that even here I was a young tenured faculty member, and I had been engaged with some excellent professors. But I felt when I arrived at Wisconsin, I didn't know much of anything about American history. So this, I look back on this as just a great experience for me. And I am very grateful that I had this opportunity.
So you mentioned earlier that you would learn, you just knock on people's doors. So is that how you were learning about U.S. history from your
colleagues? No, not so much my history colleagues, but over in the social science building, primarily.
So how were you gaining knowledge or understanding in these other fields that, fields of U.S. history that your cohorts, your colleagues were interested in or teaching about?
Well, I would, one of the things we did at that time, there was a tendency for 10, 12 faculty to go and have lunch together. And so one would learn a good bit over the lunch table. I would introduce myself to a few colleagues, and we would talk about some things I was interested in. A historian for whom I had the greatest respect, and I owe him a great deal. We never became close colleagues. This was Phil Curtin, I think one of the really distinguished historians of the last century. Phil developed, in many respects, the history of Africa here at Wisconsin, and was primarily instrumental in developing African history, African studies here at Wisconsin. For reasons I can't quite remember, Phil went to the University of Illinois to give some lectures, and I had already met Phil, and second, my wife had been a graduate student here at Wisconsin, and she had taken a course with Phil Curtin. I think it dealt with British Empire, actually. But I would go and talk to Phil a bit, and then Bill Taylor, he came here from Harvard as a young associate professor, but much more mature and advanced than I. And Bill was the one who was teaching history of the family and child rearing. There was Eric Lampard, who had actually written a brilliant history on the dairy industry in Wisconsin. I would later write a paper, and I think it's one of the better papers I ever wrote, on the dairy industry in Wisconsin that had nothing to do with Eric Lampard. But I was really getting to know people, and I would seek them out and soak up as much knowledge as I could. And part of it was just by accident, walking around Bascom Hall, having lunch with faculty, knocking on people's doors. I think I was probably unusual in that respect. But to me, it was an exhilarating experience, and I wouldn't take anything for having had that opportunity. Let me jump ahead to my second year at Wisconsin. If I had thought I was really busy the first year, as I look back, there was never anything like the second year. There was a person at the North Carolina State University in Raleigh who was doing research on a few departments in American society. And one was on what he called the Big Red Machine. That was the history department at the University of Wisconsin. Now, what was the Big Red Machine? Wisconsin had lots of graduate students across the country. And Wisconsin kept a file on most of their graduate students, what they were teaching, what they had published. And when any significant opening occurred in the country for an American historian, Wisconsin was almost always consulted. And to repeat, as I said, we had many graduate students, former graduate students out in the country. Well, the second year, I was asked to be the placement person for American history. And I was involved in placing 70 people in that year. That I will qualify that a bit. But during that year, what would often happen is that someone at a more senior level would move from one school to another, which left a vacancy at that school. And then there would be another former student, and I would make an effort to put another former student into that position, and constantly trying to move people up into a higher quality position. And then we had a significant number of other people who were either finishing their dissertations, ready to have an academic position elsewhere. And so when I say I was involved in placing 70 people, this included a number of people who had been teaching and already had significant careers and were far more advanced than I in their careers. But it was very demanding because you try to place a person at one place and it doesn't work out. So, and I was constantly, of course, consulting with my colleagues about their former students, but I carried on an extensive correspondence, and just handling the placement that year was extraordinarily demanding, but I was still pretty much conducting myself the same way as I had the first year, learning about new fields, teaching these two new courses, learning from my colleagues in other areas, and that was an incredible experience.
So as you're going along here, I don't know if you want to have space to talk about this now or a little closer to the late 60s, and that was the importance of Fred Harvey Harrington.
Let me touch on Harrington.
Okay.
Harrington was president of the University of Wisconsin when I arrived. Harrington was an American historian. He had previously been chairman of the history department, and now he'd become president. And in my opinion, Harrington was one of the great presidents of the University of Wisconsin. I think he has never received his due. During his presidency, the activities during the Vietnam War broke out, and there was a great deal of activity on this campus, and the regents tended to blame Harrington for being unable to keep the lid on things. We ended up having, on one occasion, 7,500 National Guardsmen on this campus during Harrington's years. So Harrington was eventually asked to resign by the Board of Regents. But Harrington made a big difference in the history of this university. First of all, Harrington, along with Bill Sewell, a great sociologist, the two of them, before Harrington, when Harrington was vice president of the university, had organized to try to make certain that WARF, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, funds could be shared with social scientists and humanists. Prior to then, all of this money, and there was considerable amount of money, went to support the research of natural scientists. So this was a major breakthrough at the University of Wisconsin that certainly helped to improve the quality of research in the social sciences and humanities. Harrington's field was diplomatic history, and he trained an entire generation of young historians in diplomatic history. There later became known what was called the Wisconsin School of Diplomatic History, and because there was a distinctive set of questions that Harrington's students tended to focus on. Now, Bill Williams was a student of Harrington's, and I've already talked a bit about Bill. But Harrington, for complicated and unusual reasons that I won't go into, Harrington was also became a mentor of mine. And I I got to know Harrington, not extraordinarily well. This was a very busy man who was dealing with the legislature and a rapidly expanding university. But one of the things that Harrington did, I think partly because of his background in diplomatic history, he thought globally. And now we are in the 60s, and the Cold War is going on, and there's a great deal of money from the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the American government, to support global research. And Wisconsin, like most major research universities, had little strength, if any at all, in African studies, Latin American studies, studies of South Asia. And so Harrington was one of the first to tap all of this money that might be available from the Ford Foundation and other sources. And so he was a leader in developing what one might call area studies here at the university. And very soon, Wisconsin was clearly the leader in African studies at Wisconsin. We later would have the leading African history group in every university in America who wanted to appoint an African historian, of course, would attempt to hire one of our graduate students. At one time, we taught more African languages at the University of Wisconsin than any university in the world, and many African students and even faculty would come to the University of Wisconsin to learn African languages. Under Harrington, Latin American studies, as well as Latin American history, flourished, South Asian studies. And so Harrington was a very significant individual in changing the university in some respects. And paradoxically, some of Harrington's policies operated in the longer term, had unintended consequences. We had at that time two systems of higher education in the state of Wisconsin. There was the Wisconsin State University system, and then there was the University of Wisconsin system, consisting of two campuses, the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Madison being the flagship university. But increasingly, many parts of the state of Wisconsin wanted to have their own campus and to be part of the Wisconsin State University system. And so there began to be great competition between these two systems. And partly in order to defend itself, the University of Wisconsin, Harrington began to expand. And so two new campuses came into existence, the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the University of Wisconsin, located at Parkside. So in the longer term, just as things were expanding in Madison, higher education was expanding in the entire state of Wisconsin, but causing great competition between these two systems. And the state of Wisconsin was not a very wealthy state. And so this put a great strain on the resources of this campus. And later it would lead to the merger of these two systems. And I think that would lead in the longer term to a decline in the quality of teaching at this university or in the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But I might touch on this somewhat later.
Okay.
But Harrington had an enormous impact at the university.
Thank you. So when you talked about Fred Harvey Harrington, you talked about the Vietnam War. And so I'm wondering, as you started to teach here, you know, as you started to get into year three, year four, year five, Vietnam becomes an issue on the campus. And I'm wondering how it, or did it, affect your work?
Well, in some respects, it had a very profound influence on me in my life. Again, very unintended, of course. But as most of you probably know, Wisconsin, along with Berkeley, became centers of the opposition to the war in Vietnam. And as I indicated on one occasion, because of the student activity and occasionally violence, the University of Wisconsin ended up having approximately 7,500 National Guardsmen on the campus. Now, one of the things that began to happen is that Madison had a relatively small police force, and there was a relatively small sheriff's department, and we had thousands of students on the Madison campus, and there was real fear that this would get out of control. Students were beaten up. A future mayor of Madison, Paul Soglin, was an older person in one of the city's wards, and Paul was a very activist student, and he was arrested, beaten up. The police actually ended up on one occasion shaving all of his hair off. But there was a great deal of tear gas, beating up of students and the like, students throwing stones at police and the like. So there was great concern and fear on the part of the university administration that this might just lead to violence, as is often the case when police are outnumbered and they become panicky. At this time, there was a new chancellor. Another innovation of Harrington is that during his presidency, he appointed a chancellor. And his chancellor that he brought in the same year that I came here from the University of Illinois was a law professor, a very distinguished law professor from the University of Illinois, and Fleming. And Fleming was an excellent chancellor. And then he left and became president of the University of Michigan. Harrington had a great eye for talent and always recruited excellent people. He then appointed a long-term friend of his, I've already mentioned him briefly, Bill Sewell, a sociologist and one of the great sociologists in the United States, to be chancellor. And Bill was chancellor when things really began to explode here. And Bill was a very decent man and really was, didn't know how to cope with anything of this nature. But at any rate, things began to be very explosive. At one time in Bascom Hall, we had National Guardsmen outside our office doors with rifles and bayonets. It was an amazing experience. Now, in the long, at the same time, Phil Curtin had already been instrumental in developing a program in global history, and was appointing people in different area studies. And during the war in Vietnam, I became increasingly interested in area studies. There was a program at the Social Science Research Council in New York in which quite distinguished scholars were involved, and one aspect of their program was on nation and state building. And this was in part what was going on in an effort in Vietnam on the part of the United States, was to engage in nation and state building there. And so I became increasingly interested in the problems of nation and state building. And this was in part due to the impact of people like Phil Curtin, McNeil, and the like, and my being interested in comparative history. And so in one sense, the Vietnam War had a profound interest in my intellectual concerns. Also, the fact that I was interested in comparative history and global history, I had studied revolutions. And I felt that there was nothing I could do, or most of these individuals who were involved in protesting could do locally on the Madison campus. Phil Curtin had contacts with the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation wanted a person to go to Nigeria to be involved in a program it had in overseas university assistance. And Phil came to me and asked if I might be interested in going to Nigeria. At that time, partly out of the as a result of the war in Vietnam, I was already involved in this program at the Social Science Research Council, working on nation and state building. And I think my interest, as I look back on nation and state building, intellectually, was a direct impact of of the war in Vietnam. I was thinking very seriously about the possibilities of nation and state building and how it might occur in Southeast Asia. And I became involved in that issue and became involved in the Social Science Research Council program. And I later ended up editing and writing essays in a book, A Nation and State Building. And there were some brilliant scholars involved in the SSRC, the Social Science Research Council, at the time in this particular program. There was Gabriel Ullman, the president of the American Political Science Association, Lucian Pai at MIT, and several other really distinguished social scientists. I was the only historian who seemed to get involved in that. And one of the things that puzzles me about my career is that I frequently have sort of gravitated unconsciously to great leaders in the country. But I got involved in the SSRC program, and Gabriel Ullman, who was the key figure at the SSRC in this program, sort of became my mentor. So at the same time that I was gravitating toward being interested in the politics of nation and state building, and I was getting involved in the SSRC, and Phil Curtin comes along and tells me that the Rockefeller Foundation wants someone to go to Nigeria, and I'm sure this is because of Phil's very active program in African studies. I was asked to go to Nigeria. Now, I think this was a direct consequence of the war in Vietnam. I came to the conclusion that I really was not going to be able to do anything here on the campus. As I said, I had been interested in revolutions. This was probably stimulated by the turmoil going on as a result of the war in Vietnam. And then and subsequently, I think it's very difficult to bring about fundamental changes or revolutions in societies. And at the same time, having read carefully in the work of the great French philosopher Albert Camus, I do feel we have an obligation to get involved in societal issues. And like Camus, on the other hand, I feel often very paralyzed. There's nothing much I can do about these matters. And this is sort of also a consequence of my growing up in the very racist world of Alabama. I think I have a obligation to protest. In this instance, having involved myself in some of these protests, I now chose, if you will, to follow my intellectual interest and accept this invitation to go to Nigeria. And I used the opportunity to learn a great deal about the politics of nation and state building, and became very involved in the politics of nation and state building in Europe and North America. And yet it was the African experience, the politics of nation and state building, that really provided an education for me about the politics of nation and state building. Later, the SSRC would develop a program in nation and state building involving the history of European countries and the United States, and that was a very stimulating experience. When I look back on this, I think that was a consequence of the war in Vietnam for me.
Thank you. Maybe one more thing for me this time. I think we're getting close to the hour mark, but I want to also make sure you have space to talk about some things if there are some things you feel you want to talk about this time. So to me, it sounds like you're saying that these first few years in at UW are teaching you, or you're learning about other aspects of history. You've mentioned that, but it also seems to me that you're becoming more interested in global history, maybe not global history so much, but thinking globally and thinking comparatively.
I mean, also in terms of social science, and if I may have a few minutes to talk about the social science aspect.
Sure.
This is very important. So Wisconsin later would become a leader in social science history. My colleague Alan Bogue and I were the key figures here at Madison. To a lesser extent, my colleague David Herlihy, a great medievalist, as I've indicated, we became very involved in developing social science history. And as I've indicated, I think my experience at Chicago and Pittsburgh had fueled this. And so the National Science Foundation initiated a program called the Mathematics Social Science Board in History. And two volumes came out, and I was very much involved in that. And what we were doing was try to bring social science methods, particularly statistical analysis, in the study of history. And so I was a key figure, one of the youngest people to get involved in this program. And what I was involved in, and some of my probably originated from my interest in political history, but we became interested now in voting history. And a colleague who had an enormous impact on me, another very senior professor, was Lee Benson, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And Lee had been a pioneer in developing interest in voting behavior. And so Al Bogue and I also began to be interested in voting behavior. And we all, or Lee didn't, but Al and I and several others began to bring our interest in social science history and quantitative analysis to bear. Now, one of the things that I might just touch on, which is a very interesting experience for me, we had a major conference from which there was a volume later published by Princeton University Press on dimensions of quantitative research in history. And again, as I say, this was sponsored by the National Science Foundation. And what we were really trying to do is to develop statistical methods for historical analysis. And so I and my wife, who worked with me on this project, wrote a paper, and we were dealing with 278 American cities and dealing with a great deal of data and requiring a good bit of statistical analysis. Now, I had never had a course in statistics, and throughout my life, I moved into other areas and so forth, and I'd never had courses in them, and I self-taught. But there was this conference at the University of Chicago, and there were a number of very distinguished people in attendance. And so I presented this paper with my wife on the study of expenditures in these 278 cities. And the commentator on my paper was a gentleman by the name of Leo Schnorr. Now, Leo Schnorr was one of the world's great demographers and a great statistician. He happened also to be a professor of sociology here in Wisconsin. I had never met Schnorr, but so I presented my paper. Again, I'd never had a course in statistics, and I'd never had such scathing criticism, really scathing criticism. Almost every sentence was demolished by Schnorr. And I look back on this as one of the really valuable and great experiences of my career. I learned you don't jump into a new field until you really know what you're talking about. And I never became a friend of Schnorr. Schnorr became ill, but I will always look back on him as a, if you will, a teacher, because I learned so much from that experience. And anyway, we went on the social science history continued. We started a new journal, Social Science History. It's continued to this day. And but I later became disenchanted with this program, because statistical analysis can be, if one's not careful, simply static analysis. But history is dynamic and extends across time. And so later, I became involved in being a leader on both sides of the Atlantic in developing an area called history and theory. I think we'll stop here and leave that for another time.
All right. So we'll talk about our next session and next topics here once we shut the recorder down. So this concludes the second interview with Roger Hollingsworth. We were here at his house on April 30th, 2015, and I am Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Rogers, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.